Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 334, we bring you the preview of the March 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. I'm joined by three of my colleagues to discuss topics related to complications from vitreoretinal surgery. First, we talk about complications of scleral buckling. We then move on to management of dislocated intraocular lenses. And we end with a discussion of macular peeling complications. As always, you can find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description. You can also find a link to claim CME credits on the American Academy of Ophthalmology website. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is back with a preview of the March 2022 edition of Retinal Physician. Retinal Physician available online for free at retinalphysician.com. And joining me for this, I've got three colleagues of mine, always challenging to remember whether G or K comes first in the alphabet, at least for me. But joining us from sunny California, Dr. Mrinali Gupta. Mrinali, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
The K part of that equation, Dr. M. Ali Khan, who is joining us from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Ali, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
And last but not least, I'm happy because I don't have to remember where he falls in the alphabet because he'll always fall after me, Dr. Akshay Thomas. Not joining us from Memphis, as so many times I've purported, but from Nashville, Tennessee. Akshay, welcome.
How's it going, Jay?
Good. So this edition of Retinal Physician, I like, not that I like talking about negative things, but all of these have to do with things that can happen during and after different types of surgery and how to kind of avoid problems. So the first article we're going to talk about, and remember, our job is not to be super intense in terms of covering everything in these articles. If you want to read them, you can read them for free on retinalphysician.com, but to use them as jumping off points for discussion. So first article is addressing scleral buckle pitfalls with the subtitle Stay Facile with Buckling Surgery to Ensure Best Outcomes for Patients with Retinal Detachment by Danny Mamo and Alexander Rachetskaya, both from Cleveland Clinic. So just to briefly recap, they talk about the big parts of doing a scleral buckle, the idea of you need to find a break, making sure not to have your cryoprobe in the wrong spot. And we'll talk about that in a minute. What do you do in terms of the conjunctiva? How do you decide how to address that before or after surgery? What do you do in the setting of rectus muscle mishaps, thin sclera, and the things that can happen with that? And then we really get into the stuff that gives us nightmares when we think about buckling. Deep suture passes, subretinal hemorrhage, incarceration. Oh my, who's going to do a buckle after reading this article? But it is good and important to understand all the things that could go wrong. So Mrinali, I guess let's start with just the idea of break location, planning, things like that. If you were talking to fellows or kind of teaching someone who hasn't done a lot of buckles, any big tips in terms of pre-op and intraoperative examination? I guess maybe the first thing you talk about is differences when you examine someone in surgery from just a mechanics issue and finding breaks.
Yeah, I think as we all know, the critical component to a scleral buckle surgery is to identify all of the breaks and support them appropriately with the buckle. And so I think the best place to do that, of course, is in the pre-operative exam. I lean the patient back and I take a long time to carefully look at the retina under scleral depression, 360 degrees, and I do a detailed drawing. And that helps me decide ahead of time, do I need a segmental? Do I need a circumferential component? Where's my pathology and what do I plan on doing? Am I going to drain? Might I add a gas bubble at the end? All of these surgical planning steps that are crucial before surgery. Sometimes if there's large areas of lattice in attached retina, sometimes I'll pre-treat those with laser before I do the buckle surgery so that I don't have to do a ton of cryo. Alternatively, if there's no breaks and they're supported, you don't have to treat them. And you know, on occasion, I'll rely on the exam in the operating room, especially if a patient is unable to cooperate with a good scleral depressed exam in the office. But most of the time, I usually leave the preoperative exam with a clear plan of the pathology and what I plan on doing.
Great. I love it. And, you know, we're going to bypass the discussion of the rectus muscle just because we talked about that a little bit on our sternal buccal complications podcast. And I don't want to bore our loyal listeners for the fair weather listeners who just tuned in for this one. But it is an also important note about the muscles. How about the conj? So Ali, do you do a conj assessment preoperatively? What does that look like? What sort of things are going to be absolute sort of things where you're just going to be like, look, I'm not going to do a buccal amigo vitrectomy with or without a buccal or vitrectomy instead of a straight buccal. How do you kind of deal with things if they do have prior glaucoma or strabismus surgery?
Yeah, I think those are the cases that I think the most about. So if they've had previous strabismus surgery or previous glaucoma surgery where there's a bleb or tube shunt hardware, or if they have, say, you know, osteogenesis imperfecta or some condition where the sclera is known to be thin. So I think you can see scleromalacia, or you know, you have a history of osteogenesis imperfecta usually preoperatively. And then again, with the tube shunts and glaucoma devices, you can see those. So those are cases, honestly, a straight buccal or is usually not the surgery that I choose, unless they're a very young person with a very formed vitreous. But, you know, this article goes through a lot of the things that you should do to be watching for potential issues like perforations and hemorrhages and things like that. And I think those are very real. So I've had a couple of cases where I aborted a scleral buccal intraoperatively simply because I didn't think it was safe enough, and then did a primary vitrectomy. And then with glaucoma, you know, you can use just a segment. You don't have to use a complete encircling buckler that. Although I consider myself a pretty basic buckler, so I usually do encircling bands for almost everybody. So those cases, I think you have to think a little bit harder about a primary buckle, but it can be done. And I think if it should be the surgery of choice, you can make it happen. But I think those cases just require a little bit more time intraoperatively to make sure you're covering all your bases.
Actually, any comments on thin sclera patients and, you know, the idea of aborting versus finding ways around that? What do you usually do? Let's say if you get in, it's basically.
Yeah, I mean one additional patient population group that I deal with are patients with scleritis or a history of scleritis. And they also kind of can have this very thin, you know, sclera in areas of prior scleritis. So yeah, if I get into a case and they just have, you know, abnormal sclera in one quadrant, then I may not pass sutures in that quadrant. But if it's diffuse scleromalacia, and I can't like say, or they just have all these radial dehiscence, and you know you can't just pass safely, I'd abort a buccal. One other situation, one of my colleagues, Shi Chen, ran into one of her cases was finding that someone had a Jones tube, you know, in the middle of the buccal. So they have like a direct communication between, you know, their conj and the sinuses, which is like a setup for an infection. And this, honestly, I can say, you know, it's not an area that I often look at, you know, or pay attention to, right? So it's something else to, you know, pay attention to in a preoperative assessment for a buccal.
I would have never thought of that. I probably is published somewhere. If it's not, you should publish it. Just the idea of it makes me sad. And a question, Murnali, just looping back to you before we move on to the next one. So any additional comments in terms of safety measures you do during buccals? Buccals are overall, I would say, there are a lot of things that can go wrong during a buccal. I would imagine there are probably more bad things for vision long-term that can happen during a vitrectomy, just because there's so many more diverse instruments and bad things that could happen while you're in the eye. But any other safety tips you'd have for people who are just buckling or just starting?
You know, I think that the article highlights the thing that which you alluded to, that we're most concerned about, which is the scleral passes. So choosing the right needle, a nice spatulated needle. I like the RD1 needle. Making sure that, you know, a lot of passing a good scleral buccal pass is making sure that everything is set up before you even do the pass. The assistant needs to have given you appropriate exposure. There needs not be tenon or hemorrhage or fluid in the field. You need to have good lighting. Again, you know, I get all of that stuff teed up. I make sure I'm in the right position so my arm's not tucked into my body, that I'm comfortable. And I let my assistant know I'm going to pass my scleral passes at this time. I want you to just hold the silks and don't move. And then all the technical things that the article details, you know, go slow, pay attention to the orientation of the needle, make sure you don't tip the needle back as you're pulling it out through the sclera so that the hub doesn't penetrate when you think you're done with the pass. I think the article really highlights a lot of useful basic points for passing these safely and what to do if you don't and you come across an issue.
Yeah, great points. And it's, again, it's hard in a visual format, I mean, an audio format instead of a visual format to imagine this. But I think one of the keys is that needle really should never be pointed in towards the eye. I think a lot of people make the mistake of kind of aiming in, and once they're in, then they make the turn. And if you have thinner sclera than you expect, it's a very easy way to perf right away. So I think a lot of it is just kind of using the sharpness of the needle, getting parallel the whole time, just sliding. You should be able to see that needle under the sclera the whole time you're passing it. You don't have to be really deep, and you can make up for a lack of depth with length, which is kind of my strategy for life in terms of not being the deepest person, but being a little let's transition to this next one. So we have IOL technique, management dislocated lens. Catherine Talcott, a friend of the program, wrote this up, also from Cleveland Clinic. It's a Cleveland Clinic heavy, unintentionally heavy issue and episode. So again, we talked a lot about secondary IOL pitfalls in a separate episode. It would be remiss, though, to have a secondary IOL discussion without Ali Khan himself, quoted in this article as Khan et al., which is probably the most impressive sounding et al. You could have. It's very Star Trek. So Ali, CAC does a great job here talking about all the different options, ACI wells and iris claw and iris sutured, scleral sutured, scleral fixated. It's obviously very difficult to go in great depth in a short article to talk about all of this. It's more of kind of an overview of this. And then complications, for example, are summed up in a single paragraph. There's a number of things. I don't want to pigeonhole you because you're a master of all IOL techniques and not just the sutured ones you've talked about. But let's talk a little bit about, again, preoperative examination, because I think this is probably the most helpful thing, is just what do you tell people? What do you kind of have the conversation? So just as recap, so counseling-wise, patient comes into you. I saw a patient today with dislocated lens after trauma. What's your discussion like, Ali, regarding timing? What's your discussion like in terms of, wait, how soon can I go back to work? And how soon can I go back to exercise? And when will I start to see again? What does that discussion look like in your clinic?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I agree with everything Kat said in this article. It pretty much covered pretty much the, ACIOL, iris, and PCIOL techniques, which, we all know well from, recent years, a lot of people describing these techniques. But for me, I kind of go in thinking I could probably try to do any of these techniques. So whichever one works best for this particular eye is what I'll choose. So it could be a number of things, like the quality of the conjunctiva. If you say you're doing Gore-Tex, you want to make sure those are going to be well covered. How big of an incision am I going to have to make to get the other lens out? You know, if they have a one-piece PMMA that I'm going to have to make a large incision to remove, you know, that might push me a little bit towards, say, just sliding in an AOL or something, depending on, you know, the rest of the ocular exam. So I think you have to think of everything. So conjunctiva, iris anatomy, corneal history or corneal, clarity, and then the type of, lens that you're going to go to try to remove. So I usually go in and tell the patient, look, this is my plan. However, I'm going to be ready with a few different options and we're going to choose intraoperatively which one is likely the best. All of them can be successful from a visual outcomes point. I don't think there's any data to suggest that one provides actual better visual outcomes. Just the complicated profiles can be a little different. And of course, own personal learning curve for each technique, that might decide which way you go. But in terms of kind of the postoperative things that you mentioned, I usually tell people expect that you're going to need some degree of refraction afterwards. Don't expect to have, 20/20 with no correction. All of those refractive type of discussions, I say wait at least 2 months post-surgery before we're even talking about checking for glasses and that sort of thing, because you want to make sure you don't have to remove any corneal sutures or something else depending on what happens at your op. So and I also prepare them that sometimes these lenses move. Whenever we can't use your natural anatomy, the capsular bag, there is a rate of reoperation or rate of dislocation with every single one of the possible techniques, but we expect that rate to be low for whatever reason in your case. And I think that just the idea that you could have another surgery, I think, is good to introduce, so that I think that's when patients are the most disappointed, is if there's a reoperation later.
Great. I agree with everything you said. Actually, do you have any additional thoughts and comments on counseling these patients before you take them to the OR?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I tell every single patient is that this is not like cataract surgery where you take the patch off and, you know, you expect to be seeing perfectly. I say this is going to take a long time for your cornea to clear. And this is, you know, like exactly like Lee said, I expect you to need some degree of refractive correction. I usually will talk about lens tilt. I feel like it's something that as much as we try, sometimes we just don't have absolute control over, especially if you're doing, you know, intraocular haptic fixation sutureless. So those are things that I mentioned. Additionally, I do briefly mention risks of things like UGG. I probably over-counsel the patients oftentimes for these cases, but that is something I bring up.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably appropriate. The uveitis specialist does talk about UGG when they... All right, well, Rinaldi, I'm going to ask you this, and I'll again ask Akshay and Ali to chime in. I mean, being in private practice, there isn't the same availability in your practice potentially of IOL biometry or ultrasound to get calcs. And, most people say, well, I'll get the calcs from the referring doctor if they had recent cataract surgery. That's easy enough if they had a recent cataract surgery that needed vitrectomy or a secondary lens. But you get patients, sometimes you walk in the door who they had their cataract surgery years ago and they haven't had calcs anywhere and they don't even have a lens card with them. You may not even know what type of lens is when you look in. You may not be able to tell until you get the surgery. How do you kind of manage that logistically, right? Like, what are the logistics in terms of getting calcs? How do you get that? What lenses you order and pull? I know some ORs don't have every lens in stock. How do you kind of manage the mystery box when you confront it?
Great question. You know, when I was at Cornell, I would just walk them over to our IOL calc machine and I kind of could take care of the whole thing from soup to nuts. Here in private practice, we don't have that equipment in our office. And so, like you said, if they came from another doctor, I lean on them to provide the measurements. And if they didn't, then I either send them back to whoever their anterior segment doctor has been to get those measurements, or if they don't have one, I send them to one of my colleagues in the area. And generally I ask them two things. I ask them if they can obtain the calculations for me and provide their recommendation for a few set of lenses that I'm going to have prepared to use in the operating room. And then I review those calcs on my own as well and make sure I agree with the plan. I think the lens selection is super important, and I like having two eyes on it, and they like to be involved in the selection. Sometimes it affects what they want to do with the other eye and the target refraction and all these sorts of things.
Ali, anything to add in terms of the mechanics? Is it similar for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think luckily, you know, at Wills in the OR, there's a nice consignment of a bunch of different lenses there. So you don't have to plan as far ahead. They're already there. You can just pick them. You know, if you need to sort of order some of these lenses, like the CT Lucia or others that might be better for intrascleral haptic fixation, you know, just allow yourself some time to order those, because I've had situations where they couldn't get one of the lenses if it was, you know, say an odd power. But I do similar to what Mirnali said, you know, ask the referring doctors to send the calcs, but we are able to get calcs on the day of surgery and then and calculate them on the morning if we're in a pinch. But it is nice to get them from the referring doc simply because, you know, usually the calc's done in a preoperative calm state or better than the ones where the eyes, you know, maybe have some issues with the cornea or pressure or whatever. So I think having the most native calcs are nice to use.
Actually, any final thoughts on IOL calcs? And
I mean, I'd say the one thing I'd add in the situation where, you know, either their cornea is not great or we just feel like we can't get reliable calcs at the time, I may stage the surgery. I may take out the lens in one time and put another one in another time if we absolutely need to. And it's happened on occasion. You know, someone just having a lot of chafing from the dislocated lens and there's just a lot of inflammation, you just get it out. And then I'll kind of wait before putting another lens in. But for the most part, it's very similar to the flow that Rinaldi and Ali have mentioned.
We love arbitrary numbers usually round in medicine, actually. What's your timeline between lenses?
My timeline between what?
Yeah, so if you do that, if you stage it, what's your average timeline?
Yeah, so that's a great question. It depends, right? If I was removing if I had to make a large incision to remove a PMA lens or something like that, I'd probably wait a month to let the eye kind of completely calm down so we could actually get IOL calcs. If I cut out a lens and the cornea clears more clearly, I'd probably still wait a month because I still want to get good calcs.
Perfect. Before we move on, I didn't want to distract from the conversation, but Mrunalini used the phrase soup to nuts, which I had never heard in my life until earlier today. And now two people have used that expression in 12 hours. So I had to Google soup to nuts because I didn't understand it. So this is the Wikipedia entry for soup to nuts for all of you wondering what soup to nuts. It's an American English idiom. It conveys the meaning of from beginning to end, derived from the description of full course dinner. I don't know any full course dinner I would want to end with nuts, as much as I love nuts. Usually nuts would be in the beginning, preferably with a bubbly beverage, but that is soup to nuts. It may also refer to Soup to Nuts, a 1930 feature film starring the trio who later became Three Stooges, Soup to Nuts, an episode of That's So Raven, and Soup to Nuts, an American comic strip launched in 2000, but that's spelled N-U-T-Z. So now you more know way more about this than you wanted to before you listened to this episode. And now we'll transition us very awkwardly into our last article, which is Complications from Macular Peeling. This was written by Shruti Aryapali. I think there is a strong Cole connection here. I didn't make the connection before, but I'm pretty sure she did her fellowship at Cole as well. So there's some great stuff coming out of this institution. This is about a variety of complications occur secondary to surgery. And again, she goes through all the different things that can go wrong. Again, it's great to read about complications. It's hard to imagine ERM peeling as the most common surgery vitreoretinal surgeons do without context if you just read this paper, because there's so many things that can happen. Talks about hemorrhages, talks about macular edema, scotomas, foveal displacement, which I want to ask you guys about because I think that's super interesting. Eccentric holes, RPE changes, CNVM, Donful. So Mrunalini, let's start with this ectopic fovea thing. So I feel like I try to be well-read. I also feel that I always learn new things, which is why I love doing this podcast and talking about these articles. But I'll read it and be like, huh, I knew about 80-90% of this, I refreshed, but there's always one thing I didn't really know about. I hadn't heard much about displacement towards the optic disc. They had three references there for it. They talk about this theory that there may be increased traction with an ILM peel on the temporal side, or maybe there's the mac hole is opened eccentrically, so everything ends up kind of shifted over. I've never noticed this. Now I'm going to look out for it. Is this something you were aware of? Have you noticed this in any of your patients?
No, it like you, it's not something that I was even aware of, and it's something that I don't even think I've ever looked for before. And it's something I'll probably keep an eye out for now. I think we all know that sometimes you can do an ERM case on someone with a fairly fresh ERM and the OCT looks great. There's no longer an ERM and the foveal contour is improving. And, you know, they say, oh, it's better, but it's not like it was before. And I think many of the things discussed in this article can explain, why visual acuity improves in the vast majority, but not always, and sometimes not as much as we would expect. But no, this is not something I was aware of before reading the article.
I feel better, because if Mrunalini Gupta has not heard of it, then it's unlikely that I would have heard of it. Ali, what about Donful? So Donful is something I've heard about. Rick Spades talked about this dissociation of the nerve fiber layer, dimples of the nerve fiber layer. I told my fellows, damage of the nerve fiber layer, you can come with a lot of D's, but the original D was dissociation. It is something that's been talked about, especially when you peel the nasal ILM, which is, you know, near the papular macular bundles. I've actually migrated over time for mac holes and ERMs, what I peel ILM for, to maybe peeling less on the nasal side, kind of tilting my peel a little more to the temporal side than nasal. Now I read about eccentric phobias. Now I'm wondering if what I'm doing, maybe I can't win. Ali, what are your thoughts on Donful? How much do you do the same thing? Do you still peel off the nerve fiber, not the nerve fiber layer, the ILM on the side that the nerve fiber layer is more prominent? What's your approach in terms of adjustments based on this?
Yeah, I honestly have never really changed my approach. I think I still try to do, a pretty broad ILM peel. I think that also helps maybe, I've only ever heard of that foveal displacement. Somebody said something about angle kappa and an ERM at one point, and I think that's what they were talking about. But I think the broader you get the peel to kind of, you sometimes, get more of the nasal than the temporal, I think just naturally sometimes with ILM peels, to try to make it as even as possible is what I try to do. I mean, Donful is something I feel like when you see it, you really see it on those on-foss images, and you're not sure necessarily why you had it in one case and not the other. So I haven't found anything that has really been able to change kind of the the perceived randomness of getting it. But no, I haven't really changed my technique. I always try to preserve some nasal ILM because, you know, Jay, you and I trained at the same time. So we were always taught that, you know, you don't want to, you know, pinch too hard or pull too much in those areas just because of, you know, the risk of scotomas or especially in patients with glaucoma per se. But I haven't found anything, or I haven't personally read anything that can truly avoid it if it happens. So it's one of those things where it kind of looks cool when you see the on-foss, but I don't think it's still, you know, very well understood.
Yeah, it's a great point. And this gets into my last question, actually, which is, I mean, no one ever talks about these cases. We only talk about great cases, or we talk about abject complications. But we've all had these cases, usually epiretinal membrane cases and not Mac Cole cases, right? Where you peel the ERM, and then there's kind of this residual gumminess and bogginess to the retina. And let's say you're trying to get the ILM. And I always say it's just unsatisfying. It feels like every time you grab something, you're like, is this really what the tissue layer? I think it is. You know, intraocular CT could theoretically help. I think a two-way kind of way of viewing it would also help to kind of make sure you're actually pulling the same thing. A lot of times we abort those cases at that point because you're like, you know what? I'm pretty sure I got the traction off, and I'm not really sure what this other stuff on top of is ILM. It's not, you're nodding, which I'll describe for our audience because we are in that audio format. But what, you know, what do you do in those? How often do you find those cases? Because I feel like we never talk about those cases because there's no real way to describe it. There's no word I've heard for it, but we've all had that. And we don't really know what it is, and we just kind of move forward. And so those patients oftentimes still have residual folding and kind of redundancy of the retina after you see them. I don't really know a way to relax that.
No, I agree. I think there was a video, I have to think about where I saw it, where someone was describing, like, intraoperatively, they were trying to peel more, and they realized they had some, like, nerve fiber layer ascites, that they were about to, like, peel some nerve fiber layer. So yeah, I agree with you. Once I feel like I've gotten all the ERM and I'm just not sure what I'm feeling, especially since I don't have intraoperative OCT, I stop there. You know, come back, you can always come back and fight another day if you absolutely needed to, but if you peel some nerve fiber layer, it's really bad form.
Yeah. Ali Mernali, any other thoughts on nerve fiber layer trauma or those types of peels?
No, I mean, I've always found that sometimes restaining is helpful. So I think we're all kind of worried about ICG toxicity and stuff like that. But if you're not sure what you're peeling anymore, it might be a good idea to restain. And I found that I've never really regretted doing that. So I think ERMs could be very different. Some super simple, some especially, you know, post RD, they're almost like PVR type cases rather than a true epiretinal membrane. So they could be pretty variable in how easy they come on or come off. But it's still, you know, a very enjoyable, fun surgery. So I think why we're sometimes interested in some of these things like Donful and other things is because, you know, we're kind of interested in knowing if we're doing anything to cause it. But, you know, I don't think there's a ton of consensus on why some of these things happen. And I think what kind of Mernali said, that sometimes you just get these patients that are somewhat disappointed and you're not necessarily sure why. And I think that's what makes us all think about what we're doing from a technique point of view.
Yeah. And that goes into kind of my last question about this, Mernali, which Ali talked about these satisfying, great surgeries. I think in the least pleasurable of these cases, besides the ones I talked about, are sometimes these really high myopes. There's multiple reasons. If you have a very highly myopic fundus with an ERM, or more likely a myopic Mac Cole, you've got this long reach to deal with. You've got this ILM that usually doesn't stain very well. You've got this retina that's super thin. The ILM is tight. Every time you grab something, it feels like it bleeds or it's pulling on the retina and it doesn't make you feel good. You get a little nauseous and a little vasovagal every time it happens. and then they usually are snoring and moving around. And you can't wake them up too. So it's like a constellation of things. Any tips for kind of those harder cases? I'm just trying to imagine. I feel like besides just not being able to see, which that there's a lot of reasons your visualization can be compromised. I feel like those are the hardest cases for people, is just because of the angles of your hands and then just the way the ILM tends to behave.
Yeah, you know, I do like using the Ingenuity for macular cases. I think that there is some enhanced stereopsis and visualization of the planes for that. And then I think, you know, it sounds super simplistic, but I just try to do my best, as we tell the fellows, to optimize everything that I can before I start my peel, which is, you know, get a good stain, make sure I remove all the stain, make sure my light pipe is at the right setting and I have a really good magnification and focus and lighting of where I'm working. And if I need to, as Ali said, I restain. But, you know, yeah, sometimes these peels come off nicely, and it's the most satisfying thing I think that I can experience in the operating room is like a nice ILM or ERM peel. And then sometimes, you know, uveitic eyes, some diabetics, some just for some reason they're sticky and you don't get a nice clean sheet and you're just kind of pulling at it. And I think the key for those is, as Ali mentioned, is to restain. Also to, if I need, I might sometimes use the flex loop and kind of get little bits off in that way. And then knowing when to stop, because a lot of the times these aren't the sort of cases where it would be the end of the world if something got left behind that needed to go back in later. But if you don't have a membrane that's coming off well, and you're not sure you're in the right area, and it's quite possibly not causing a lot of traction, and leaving it is just fine.
Akshay, you gonna let her talk about your uveitic eyes that way?
Yeah, I mean, well, yes, you will. Well, I'll let it go this one time. But I mean, you know, one thing I would add, you know, I agree with everything Morelli said. The one thing I'd add is that I don't know if everyone on this podcast episode are they pinch and peel or use flex loop, but I tend to probably use, you know, the flex loop at least in 50% of my cases, especially in those myopic eyes, and ones with like a lot of schesis. I do like using the flex loop because I feel like I can just apply the right amount of pressure and make sure I'm actually getting a flap of ILM and ERM rather than pinching and taking some nerve fiber layer with it. I feel like I have just a little bit better sense of what exactly I'm peeling.
We'll clarify Dr. Thomas's disclosures with companies that make the flex loop, which is only one that makes the proprietary name flex loop, in the episode description. But it's a point well taken about I like a loop scraper, flex loop, rarely, but those are the cases that I will like it. Macular peeling. Last question, just out of curiosity, and this has nothing to do with complications. What do you all do for tamponade and ERM peels, right? So like, I remember in fellowship, there'd be attendings who'd be like, oh, there's a lot of edema over here. I'm going to put air and let's put them face down and see if it does anything. I'll go first and say, I do air for almost all my vitrectomies as long as I'm not putting an IOL or they don't need vision immediately. So I'll put like a partial air fill, mostly for the sclerotomies. Akshay, working backwards, what do you do?
Exact same thing. I do a partial airfill just to ensure that my sclerotomies are watertight. I think I may lay them on under a full airfill if there's been like an iatrogenic break without a detachment or something. But that's essentially it.
Ali, how about you? Do you ever position? I'm sure you remember that we had a couple attendings who would position face down for ERM sometimes.
Yeah, no, I don't position, but I do pretty full air fluidics. I do pretty full air fill. Like I don't get a soft tip and go down to the nerve. I just use the cutter and get as close as I think is safe. I think it's helpful. You know, I feel less pressure to suture sclerotomies, and then, you know, the IOP drop on day one, I'm less worried about. And also buys me a little bit of time to tell them, look, it's going to be blurry while the bubble's in there, and just get you through that first week with an excuse per se. But I agree. I don't do it if there's an IOL or, you know, some other reason not to do it, say they're monocular or functionally monocular, then I don't necessarily put them through that. But, you know, there's been, you know, prior studies looking at using air fills to prevent post-op hypotony and post-op, you know, endophthalmitis for, you know, kind of in the same vein. So I like to use it. I haven't really had any downsides from it. So I'm going to stick with it.
Rinaldi, Ali's saying his eye is more full of air than the Lakers roster is filled with aged out veterans. How about you? How much air do you have in your eye?
I do the same. I use a soft tip and I don't drain it super dry all the way down to the nerve, but I get a pretty full fill. And like you, I almost every case is left either under gas, oil, or air.
Perfect. Well, guys, thanks so much for talking about these articles. Not to open a can of worms, but it's topical since this is the first episode we're recording post-approval. So faricimab approved within the last couple of weeks. We're recording this February 24th. Approved. It's an anti-VEGF Ang-2 inhibitor from Genentech. Approved for the treatment of wet AMD and DME based on the results of the Tenaya and Lucerne studies. I think jury's out. We'll have to see real world data. We could talk about safety and all these things for another hour if we wanted to. But just quick hitting answers. Everyone wants to know, Murali, when are you going to start using it, assuming there's insurance approval, and which patients are going to be the first ones that you would use it in?
Yeah, I think two sides. I look forward to using it. I think after the whole Bayview thing, I'm probably going to sit tight for a little bit for most of my patients and see how it goes. And early on, I'll tend to use it on those patients who are requiring monthly injections and either just can't get in for that for their wet AMD or have persistent fluid despite monthly anti-VEGF injections. And from a logistical standpoint, we'll probably end up starting with Medicare as well.
Akshay, how about you? Similar?
Pretty much the same. Wait for the J-code to get approved and then sit on it for a while. Make sure the safety data is as good as looked at the studies and then take it from there.
Ali?
Yep, same. I think coverage is going to be the thing that actually probably dictates how early the adoption is. But you know, I don't necessarily see a reason why you shouldn't just start using it off the bat per se, other than trying to wait to see if there's any post-market issues there. Because you know, I don't foresee any other reason to consider holding off, even if you had somebody who's on stable, say aflibercept or ranibizumab, I think a lot of patients would be interested in trying to see if their interval was extended. So I think, like Murali was mentioning, people who couldn't be extended on other drugs, I think are a safe first target. And I think as, I get comfortable with it, maybe just, start from the beginning, but I think we'll see what happens. But the natural lag from the insurance approval will probably give us some time to figure it out.
Yeah, I echo everything everyone said. I think the interesting conversation, which I didn't even think about, is probably the patients I would start in, assuming everything's approved, be wet AMD patients who really don't respond to anything else, or incomplete or non-responders. I don't have many, but statistically, we all have about 5 to 10% of our patients who have some sort of recurrent, persistent IRF, SRF, or they just don't respond to anything. And I have a couple of patients like that who sort of been treading water, but they're not really getting vision improvements that maybe are motivated to try this, assuming it crosses safety signals. DME is more interesting for me. I remember talking to someone about this. I haven't really thought about it in the context of my DME algorithm, just because we have so many options, including corticosteroids. And I guess for a treatment naive patient, you would prefer it over a corticosteroid. But I feel like the patients of mine who are established, who have already, which is a small percentage, who have already quote unquote not succeeded with the current anti-VEGF agents, are all stable on some sort of long-term corticosteroid and proven they're not steroid responders, or they were steroid responders, but they had a tube or something done to address it because they've been there for years. And then I don't feel like I have that many DME patients who are like reliant on anti-VEGF where they need it monthly or every 6 weeks at this point, because again, it tends to burn out. So I don't know where that will fit in. I have to think about it. But anyway, actually, any final thoughts on DME versus AMD?
Yeah, I think for the DME, it's probably going to be the first ones that I started might be the ones that are getting, occasional steroid injections or just not completely dry centrally. But yeah, I think that's pretty much, I'll have to think about this. That was a little bit more complicated, I think, than the AMD.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you all so much for your insights, for your time covering this edition of Retinal Physician with me. And I look forward to seeing you all in person. I think I'm going to see everyone on this call in person within the next 5 weeks, assuming bad things don't happen in the world between now and then. So thank you all and look forward to meeting up.
Thank you.
Take care, guys.
Many thanks to Doctors Gupta, Khan, and Thomas for joining me for this episode. Remember, you can find all 334 episodes, including this one, on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. There are all the episodes there archived and sorted by category, easily searchable. You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter at RetinaPodcast. You can subscribe to episodes as they release in the podcast app on your mobile device or by putting your email in on our website and getting email updates on episodes as they release. Remember that we love new episode ideas, so if you have ideas for the future, please let us know. Thanks to Jennifer Ford and the team at Pentavision for allowing us to preview these articles in advance. Thank yous to Dr. Louis Kai, Mike Vinikas, and Angela Chang, or Do Every Time, for the work they do behind the scenes for the podcast, doing production and social media. Many thanks to you, listeners, for the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here each week, and the patients you take care of on a daily basis. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off. feeling.
This is straight from the